This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When he was a boy in the 1950s, Edmund White tried to find a cure for his homosexuality. He eventually gave up trying and became one of the most important writers chronicling gay life and culture. He's written many books of nonfiction, including a biography of the writer Jean Genet, which won a National Book Critics Circle Award. And he's written several autobiographical novels. Now he's written an autobiography called My Lives. The book is divided into chapters titled My Shrinks, My Father, My Mother, My Hustlers, My Women, My Blondes, and My Friends. Let's start with a short reading from the chapter titled My Shrinks. White's mother was a child psychologist, and when he was a child, she sent him to psychologists. He writes that when he was 15, he stopped thinking of homosexuality as being interestingly artistic and saw it as a problem to be overcome.
Already I hoped to be a writer, but as I was beginning to realize, successful writing entailed a grasp of universal values and eternal truths, which were necessarily heterosexual. Foolishly, I had imagined I could transform the dross of homosexuality into the gold of art. But now I saw I could never be a great artist if I remained ignorant of the classical verities of marriage and child-rearing, adultery and divorce. But if psychoanalysis could convert me into a heterosexual, might it not at the same time ablate the very neurosis that made me want to write? Should I tamper with my neurosis?
That's Ed White reading from the first chapter of his new autobiography, My Lives. Ed, welcome back to Fresh Air. The first psychologist who you knew was your own mother, who she became a child psychologist when you were young, and she practiced on you. The way you describe it, she practiced administering Rorschach tests on you and psychoanalyzing you. Was there anything inappropriate to you about that looking back?
Well, looking back, yes. At the time, of course, you don't really judge your parents that much. Now, looking back, yes, of course, I realize it was very crazy and that it wasn't, if your mother says to you, you have severe psychological problems and you're 7 or 8 years old, that's not an objective piece of information for you, the child. It becomes something that shapes you and damages you and makes you lose your confidence in yourself and feel that you're very weird. And that certainly is the way I felt.
Are you describing what actually happened, that she told you this and that was how you reacted?
Yeah. I mean, she did really want to test me all the time. For instance, I remember she gave me a Rorschach, and she was very dismayed because I didn't see any human beings in it. I only saw gravestones and diamonds and totally weird, impersonal things. And maybe quite correctly, she saw that as a sign of a kind of borderline psychosis. I certainly was a very disturbed child, partly because I felt enormously guilty about my parents' divorce. And soon after they did get divorced, I locked myself in the bathroom and I wouldn't come out, and I kept screaming, "I did it, I did it, I did it." I mean, it's almost like a classic example of an Oedipal complex, of where the boy wants to get rid of the father, and then when he does, he feels terribly guilty.
Were most of the psychologists you were sent to when you were young, because you were gay, or there are other reasons why your mother sent you to psychologists or that you wanted to see psychologists?
Oh, it was because I was gay, and it was mostly I was the one who initiated all this. I mean, I think I had, Sartre talks about people who have a bad faith, an act of bad faith. That is, they're not being honest with themselves. And I think I was a classic example of that kind of bad faith, because on the one hand, I was lusting after boys my own age and even older men. And that's what I really wanted. And I was obsessed with that idea of having some sort of sex with older people. But on the other hand, I knew that it was a bad thing, and I also knew that it would limit me as a writer, because that was very much the idea in the air, that a writer could only be successful if he could touch on universal topics. And homosexuality was obviously too narrow a focus or too neurotic a point of view to ever make a successful writer. So for various reasons, some of them artistic already, even at that early age of 14, 15, but also just because I wanted to be a regular guy. I mean, teenagers do want to be like other teenagers, and it's really hard to perceive that you're different.
Your father didn't like the idea of psychologists because they cost so much money, and he was already paying alimony by this point. But you say he also believed that mental problems could be cured through willpower and self-discipline. Did you ever try to, through willpower and self-discipline, become straight?
Yeah. I mean, I went through a period where I was a Buddhist as a teenager, and I would meditate every night. And of course, part of the kind of Buddhism I subscribe to, which was the Hinayana, the earliest kind, part of that is a giving up all your desires, including your sexual desires. But, I mean, you're supposed to root out from yourself your hankering after money, fame, love, sex, success of any sort. You're supposed to, because those are the things that keep you attached to the world and cause you to be reborn. Well, I think if Buddhism appealed to me so much, and if I actually tried to apply it to my life, it was because I was so guilt-ridden about being gay.
It's so interesting to think of you practicing that kind of Buddhism, because your books are so much about the kind of attachments that you were trying to give up as a young Buddhist.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's a real conflict. But I also think that is sort of the heart of the religious experience. I mean, I'm an atheist now, and one reason I was attracted by Buddhism was because you could be an atheist and be a Buddhist. But in any event, I do feel like, at least as a teenager, I had a very strong religious side, spiritual side. And I think part of that, I mean, a real sign of that spiritual vocation is that you'd be in deep conflict about it. I have a lot of Texas relatives who are born-again Christians, and I always say to them, I don't believe you really believe. And they'll say, what do you mean? What do you mean? I say, because you never have any conflict about it. I mean, all the great spiritual leaders I know of, whether it was Emerson or Nietzsche or different ones, all went through these, certainly Kierkegaard, went through these terrible crises of faith. And you see that in the 19th century again and again, when people still really did believe. Their beliefs were constantly being shattered and tempted and rewritten, and they anguished over the whole thing a lot.
The first gay therapist who you saw was Charles Silverstein, who you later collaborated with on the book The Joys of Gay Sex. What year was it that you started seeing him?
That would have been in the mid-1970s, and maybe 1974, and then the book came out, The Joy of Gay Sex came out in, I think, 76 or 7.
So what are some of the insights you got from actually seeing a therapist who was gay as opposed to a therapist who was trying to make you straight?
Well, it was interesting because he wasn't at all interested in talking about what caused homosexuality. And if I would sort of start harping on that, usually in a very ready-made, rehearsed way that I had learned from my earlier therapist, he would just sort of look away or lose interest. But what he was interested in was why I kept choosing to be involved with people who spurned me, why I was always unhappy in love, why I couldn't seem to settle down with somebody who liked me. And I think that, quite correctly, he saw as an aspect of gay self-hatred. And he would do very interesting things. Like I would say, yes, it's true, I hate myself. Then he'd bring in to the next session a mirror, and he'd say, okay, now I want you to look at yourself in the mirror, and I want you to list all the things you like and all the things you don't like. What was interesting is that there were many, many things I did like, and that surprised me. I mean, I had qualities that I did approve of and that I do and did like, but the ones I didn't like were very intense and deep. So I think that was very illuminating.
We had been talking about your chapter, My Shrinks. You have a chapter called My Hustlers. You say in your book that you first became interested in hustlers because in your world when you were younger, in the world you were living in, it was hard to find anybody that you thought was gay. But you could tell if a guy was a hustler, so that's who you had your relationships with. But you remained interested in hustlers, and I guess I'm wondering why. I mean, you're somebody who could have had many relationships without ever seeing a hustler again, without ever having paid again.
I guess it was always sort of exciting for me. I mean, for instance, I can remember when I was in my 30s and I was still pretty presentable looking, and I was working, doing a lot of freelance writing. And one way I'd make myself stay at my desk was to know that at midnight, somebody would be coming up those steps to see me. So in a way, I suppose if you pay for sex, one of the advantages is that you can get exactly the person you want physically, and you can orchestrate when it'll take place and under what circumstances and so on. I mean, in other words, it's one aspect of being a control freak is that, people who go out, even very attractive people who go out cruising, spend an awful lot of time in bars, hours and hours and hours and hours, trying to line somebody up. I mean, and that's true whether you're straight or gay. But I think that one of the advantages of, but also it sounds so impersonal when you talk about hustlers, but almost everyone I've ever seen, I've gone on seeing for a long period of time. I've always had very close relationships with these guys, most of whom are middle class, most of whom have other jobs, most of whom are educated and are fun to talk to. Oftentimes they're other writers. So it's not like it's quite the barren, impersonal thing that it might sound as if it might be.
You have a picture in the back of the book of the man who's been your partner since 1995. So should I assume here that he's okay having his picture in the book? And you saying that he's his partner while you're writing about all these other relationships you've had.
Well, he is very tolerant. Poor guy. Maybe he's too awfully long-suffering. But, I mean, we really love each other. And we have a very tender, close, supportive relationship. He's a writer. We read each other our work. I especially read to him. He's a little more reluctant to read to me. But we certainly have an enormous esteem for each other. And I really think that maybe the first two, we've been together 11 years now, the first 2 years maybe we had some quarrels, but we haven't had any since then. We really get along very well.
Is there anything that really surprises you about what has happened with gay culture since Stonewall? I mean, you were active in the gay rights movement, you know, back then, and you've watched gay culture evolve, gay life evolve. What surprises you most?
Well, I think in the 70s, that most gay leaders, who the visible active leaders politically, were leftists. And it's because I think people who were conservative and gay felt they had nothing to gain by coming out, at least in a political way. So the gay movement was quite radical and progressive, and there was a tremendous emphasis on linking up the gay fight with the fight of women, of blacks, and of other minority groups. I think that that isn't the case anymore, that what happened in the 80s was AIDS killed off a lot of those radical leaders and flushed out of the closet a lot of more conservative middle-class people who sort of took over the movement. And I think that's fine, but it has meant that the whole movement as a political movement has drifted very much to the right, as has the whole culture. And in the same way, I think that gays used to feel they had to be cultured, that the most important thing about proving that you were eligible for gay culture was to have an opinion about Maria Callas, or to have seen the latest Pasolini movie, or to have read the latest André Gide journal. Now, there's very little pressure to do that, and I think that gay culture has been dumbed down the way the rest of the culture has been dumbed down, and that gays feel that the most important thing is to go to the gym and look great, and or maybe have a very good job. And But I'm, of course, exaggerating slightly, because maybe the final thing to say about difference between now and the past is that gay culture has become extremely pluralistic, so that you have many people who are skinny and don't go to the gym and who are artistic and live in the East Village. And you have many people who live in Chelsea, where I live, who have these big showboat bodies and go to the gym and are mostly interested in that. And you have gays of absolutely every stripe and variety. And you have many, many people who don't define themselves by their sexuality anymore. I mean, it's quite common for me to meet a younger person who, after I've known him for a few weeks or months even, I'll find out sort of in passing that he is gay. But that isn't the most important thing for him about his identity. Whereas I think in an earlier period of oppression, it was very important to everybody's identity.
You were diagnosed as being HIV positive back in 1985. And your health is still good?
Yeah, only last summer, for the first time to ever start taking meds. I mean, I never was on any kind of medication until last summer. And it turns out I'm what's called a slow progressor. And about 4% of people who are HIV positive are slow progressors. That is, their numbers drift down very, very, very slowly, and mine over a period of 20-some years. And then in my case, I did need to finally start taking meds, but once I started taking them, I felt tip-top again. So,
I'm wondering how having that kind of cloud hanging over your head of being HIV positive has affected your life. You know, because you probably thought at one point that that was an early death sentence. And
I definitely did, yeah.
And you know, thank goodness it turned out not to be. But you didn't know that. So did you make changes in your life based on the fact that you thought that you might not have long to live?
Well, I think it's made me very productive. I mean, I think that I'm very grateful for every year that has been granted me. And so many of my contemporaries died. I mean, I belong to a writer's group called the Violet Quill, and there were 8 of us, and only 3 of us are still alive. And so I think, you know, I sometimes feel that I'm writing the books they might have written, or I'm expressing the things that otherwise would be lost. Or anyway, I do feel very grateful about having been given this extra lease on life.
Well, Edward, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it so much.
Ed White's new autobiography is called My Lives.